Okay, so my first question to you in this section, I'm going to save the what video game would you like to create for the last question, so you can you know, marshal your thoughts a little bit. First question I have is about, let me ask a video game question first. So one thing we didn't get to in the podcast, and what I think we should get to in another one, is your distaste or just your inability to kind of like deal with, I don't know how you'd want to describe it, Japanese user interfaces. So for like specifically Japanese games like RPGs or JRPGs, I'm assuming you're thinking of here. What is it that puts you off?
It applies to all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
Like, yeah, I think, and this kind of comes back to what we were talking about on the main podcast, where I was talking about, you know, established conventions of how particular user interactions work. And it's just always so exceedingly clear to me that the Japanese conventions for these things have developed in parallel but completely differently to Western ones. You know, and that ranges from things that just kind of frustrate me. Like, I remember, I want to say Street Fighter 4 on maybe the Xbox One or something. Some console. Street Fighter 4, mapping the buttons, mapping the controls, rather than just having, you know, hey, here's light punch, press the button you want light punch to be, you know.
Right.
There was a row for every single control, light punch, medium punch, hard punch, and then as you selected each one of those fields, it had, you know, an X or an L1 or whatever, and you had to just scroll sideways through every single button on the controller until you found the one you wanted, and then move down to the next one, and then scroll sideways until you found the thing. There's things like that where I'm just like, who would do that? Why would you do that? You know, it's really, really frustrating to me. But also, you know, there's, I don't know, I find a lot of the stuff that I talked about on sort of in the main podcast about what really appeals to me in games, which is just kind of freedom of movement and freedom of expression in a character. I feel like a lot of Japanese games are just kind of the antithesis of that. Like things like, I want to say games like, you know, Devil May Cry and Resident Evil games and stuff like that, where it's just so apparent that you are moving on a very set path. You're in a corridor, you know, like the bounding on everything is so strict. Your character kind of never leaves the ground. You can't climb over anything. You jump about a foot. Like everything seems really stiff.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely sure that for games like Resident Evil, the Resident Evil series and stuff, that those are probably often conscious design choices to kind of inhibit and limit your movement to make it more tense to try and shoot a monster or to try and get away or any of that
certainly.
Sort of thing. But I just find it intensely frustrating. There's that part, you know, like things like the user interfaces and menus themselves, things like in the like Silent Hill games and stuff, like when you just go in and try and like mess with your inventory, and it's every time I get into one of those things, I'm just like, what are we doing here? How is this meant to work? Why do I have to take this item out of my inventory and put it back into my inventory first before I can put a thing in instead of just swapping them, you know? Really minor things.
I'm fighting
that
a little too. Yeah.
Oh, look, you know, I'm sure that things like this seem, you know, almost petty to a lot of people. But like I said, to some extent, it is my bread and butter. And to other extents as well, you know, I find that it takes me out of things so badly. That the way, for example, things like control schemes are mapped, the way, you know, characters move, the way like dialogue happens so much of the time, where you can't skip anything, you can't interact with anything. There's just a lot of stuff. I suppose there's a lot of things where I feel like a lot of freedom is being taken away from me in the game. Often a lot of sort of seemingly very deliberately restrictive experiences, and it's kind of the opposite of what I look for and enjoy and value in games.
Interesting. No, that's a great answer. And I definitely want to talk. We should have you on again because I want to talk about whether or not you consider that whether or not we consider that like a cultural difference or not. But that's really interesting. So let me ask you on the topic of cultural differences. So since you have your own podcast about Australia, which everyone should go listen to, go listen to Bunta Vista. But I want to ask you because I didn't ask Matt Brady about racism, which feels like a missed opportunity. but I won't ask you about racism. I'm interested in asking you about, so what of the sort of, and you can determine what they are, because I'm sure you've heard them all at this point. Which one of the sort of outsized Australian stereotypes do you feel is actually the truth? And in a gesture of good faith, I'll say the American one is almost certainly that we like extraordinarily big things in terms of portions, in terms of like cars and everything. That is true almost around the entire nation, even in like cities and, you know, whatever. No matter how progressive anyone is, they always want a bigger steak at a certain level.
You'll be pleased to know that we've started to get the gigantic trucks here.
Good. Great.
Like just some massive like Ford pickups and stuff.
That's important. It makes you understand what, like, it delineates by sort of like manliness cast. It's a crucial thing to building a truly terrible society.
The unfortunate answer to that is that I think there's a pretty distinct image of like the Australian abroad, you know, in the same way that there's the stereotype of the American tourist. The loud American tourist slowly asking people if they speak English.
And that happens too.
We've all been there, we've all seen it, but it's not everyone. but yeah, in the same way, you know, there's a reputation in this part of the world for Australians going to holiday destinations which are sort of nearby in the South Pacific, like places like Bali and Thailand and yeah, of like, we go there to get ratchet drunk and get into fights and just kind of trash the place. And oh, I remember the last time I was coming back from Europe. This was years ago, but and we had a stopover in an Asian airport. And I'm going to revise that completely. I was coming back from my honeymoon in Thailand.
Oh,
and
there you go.
Waiting at the desk at the airport, and all the guys in line behind us who were in a group together, like, all had bad sunburns, fresh tattoos, and black eyes.
No!
all wearing singlets and thongs, and I was like, come on, guys, just come on. And yeah, unfortunately, I think if you look at Australia's present discourse about different political issues and what features the most heavily, unfortunately, it's all pretty xenophobic. What with the recent attacks in like Manchester and London, suddenly a bunch of media outlets in Australia are entertaining the concept of internment.
Wow.
Yep. So, you know, we already have our own situation, as I talked about before, with former Attorney General, Federal Attorney General Philip Ruddock, who, sort of architected this whole awful thing that we've got going on, which is now being carried along by the current government, where we just, if people arrive here trying to seek asylum, as is their, you know, legal right internationally, what we do is go out and meet them in the water so that they can't actually set foot on Australia and claim asylum. And we either turn their boat around and push it back out, like literally. If the boat is damaged enough, a damaged enough, we will put them in these kind of indestructible lifeboat vessels that we have had made for this purpose. and tow them back out into international waters, and sometimes push them into another country's waters. And
that's so petty.
And if they
and
do
so
manage,
cruel.
To, yeah, it's well, that's not even the cruelest part. So we also have a system where if people do manage to get into you know Australian waters, but not onto Australian land, we take them offshore to some small Pacific Island countries where we have these prisons set up, and we put them in there, and they don't get charged with a crime or anything. We just tell them, oh, we are assessing your status as a refugee, and then we just kind of leave them there for, you know, upwards of 5 years.
Yeah, there's a there's a Half-Life 2 mod that I played a while ago. It's very interesting, called Escape from Woomera, which is about basically it's you know, you are a refugee in one of these internment camps, and you just like walk around and talk to other refugees and try and like fashion an escape route out, and it's unfinished, which I guess is a kind of interesting metaphor.
Oh, that'll be referring to the Woomera Immigration Reception and Processing Center.
That's correct. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's really hard to believe when I learned about it.
Well, that wouldn't exist anymore because we don't actually let people like come to Australia now. That was the problem. If somebody came to Australia and they were found to be a legitimate refugee, we would eventually have to acknowledge that and allow them to have asylum here, which is what led to the whole keeping people in these offshore gulags in this state of perpetual mystery about what their fate was going to be.
God, I can't imagine it could have gotten worse.
It's pretty horrible national identity stuff, to be honest. It makes a lot of people like me pretty sad on a regular basis. That like,
yeah, I bet.
Well, and it's turned into kind of like a it's something that an election was won on a long time ago, and it's become an issue that both major parties, who are roughly analogous to the Republicans and Democrats, are just both too scared to move in either direction about, so they both just say, ah, we'll keep doing that.
Ugh.
So unfortunately, that's the kind of very xenophobic stereotype in my head, is that apparently the majority of people in this country who vote will vote for a party that makes a very big deal about intending to continue that, or make it harsher if they can.
Ugh. Well, I will ask you a more uplifting final question. Although I was gonna say that is not meant to shame you. I appreciate your candor on that one. I think like it's a better like answer than, oh yeah, we all play like, you know, you call this a knife, this is a knife kind of thing, right? Like,
yep.
That, you know, it is a modern country with all of the same basic problems, even though we kind of infantilize you guys all the time.
you call that mistreatment of refugees?
rough chuckles. I remember, I mean, to speak to Australians abroad, the one thing I always thought was true about Australians in a positive sense was that you guys get a very humane set of vacation days from work compared to Americans. We do.
Nice. I think there's a lot of things here that I think a lot of American people would be like, what? Everybody, if you have like a full-time job, then you will get like 4 weeks of paid vacation a year.
They stack, right?
Yeah, you get like two. Well, it depends on the job and all that sort of stuff. Although there's very much the same kind of increased casualization of the workforce that there is everywhere else.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, generally speaking, like if you work in a permanent job, you'll get sick leave that they pay for, and then you can go to the doctor, and it gets subsidized by the government, and you don't walk out with a several thousand dollar fee, you know.
Yeah,
as I said about a year ago, on Twitter, after I had a pretty bad bike accident in traffic, and like I broke some ribs and stuff, and I went to the hospital, and I went in and I got x-rayed and ultrasounded and treated and all this stuff, and they gave me medication and everything and sent me home with a bill of $0. And I was like, this is good, and I try to not take it for granted.
Yeah, good.
Because it's not something that everybody else in the world gets to enjoy, and it's something that I wish more people in the world had access to.
Even our best case scenario here involves a fairly hefty bill. It's just a matter of whether that bill will put you in debt for the rest of your life or not. Yeah, wow, we're digging this depression hole even deeper.
My bad.
No, hey, again, I appreciate your candor, which will cycle us back into. So last question. I asked this of everyone. Everyone so far has given a tremendous answer, so no pressure. Given total freedom of finance, ability, market, whatever, you just have, you're sort of like at a god position in terms of this. What is the ideal game you would create?
Well, I think for me it would probably be some kind of intersection of the whole open world experience, and probably VR, I guess.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, well, that was something that that I meant to touch on before, but I couldn't actually remember the name of the game. it's called like Hotwire or Hotline or something.
It's that
VR game where everything's all white and the other characters are red.
Yes. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. I can't think of the name either.
It has some kind of control scheme where I think like while you're not moving, everything sort of slows down to bullet time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you can kind of see what's going on, and then you can move and, you know, deflect bullets and punch dudes in the face or whatever. Which, you know, I found myself thinking as clearly that sort of stuff is going to be the future tense of of the kind of stuff we were talking about in terms of just creating a world and letting someone go in and experience, you know, what they want to experience in there.
Yeah.
And ideally, I suppose, in the future, you'll effectively end up with an intersection between like VR and movies, basically. Where someone can say, here's a whole experience, here's a whole narrative that we've programmed out for you. You can just jump in there and effectively like live as a character in a movie. You know, and that could extend to experiences that are like David Fincher movie, The Game.
Oh, hey, there you go.
You know, where that was remember that whole kind of craze of
I do, the sort of like post Running Man craze.
Yeah, a game, but it's in real life, that kind of thing. They have, well, I guess people are still doing that sort of thing where they set up, you know, a whole area full of actors pretending to be zombies and you run through and paintball them or whatever it is that you do.
Yeah, or like the ARG craze that kind of comes and goes every so often, where like, you know, companies will send out codes and people will get into this massive mystery hunt and.
Well, even those puzzle room things that people do.
Oh yeah, of course. You know? Yeah.
I see the future as being that kind of intersection of narrative and like cinematic narrative and you embodying the lead character and them actually being able to create a world in that pretty sort of high definition sense. And it's funny as well because like what I was thinking about earlier when we were talking about you know, the idea that people want to inhabit an avatar or a character or a powerful figure and live through that. One of the images that came to mind for me was that I was reading a piece earlier in the week about the original Matrix movie. And they were talking about that scene. I want to know Kung Fu. And you just download Kung Fu into your head. And you know that now. And that's kind of what I would, in my ideal my ideal imagining of games in the future is a thing where you can say, all right, this is the experience I want to have now. This is a thing I want to be able to act out and portray.
It's very Fifth Element of you. It's like there's a kind of it's interesting that you say all that, and I agree with you, and I think like going back to our previous discussion of why like Call of Duty might appeal to us as like the particular age we are, there's a whole period of sci-fi from like Demolition Man to Fifth Element to all of these films that like hint at this idea of like being able to plug into something and just be it. As like not always as a main plot point in both of those movies, it's not a main plot point, but like just being able to get a virtual boost or something like that, be able to experience something that you would have to train for 50 years and then be able to feel it or experience it even if you couldn't do it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the through line of what we were talking about, where from playing a game like Call of Duty, you know, one of the ones where you're reliving, you know, particular battles and particular conflicts and all that kind of stuff, because they're experiences that you can't have. You can only attempt to replicate them somehow. And you know, or like, I'm sure that on some levels you could argue that it's a crass cheapening of the horrors that people actually went through. I'm sure that on another level, if you wanted to take a totally different tack, you could say, you know, by creating a really realistic version of this experience, maybe you can just glean the tiniest sense of what it's like, or what it would have been like for somebody to be in a situation like that. I'm sure that's what people sort of really appreciated about things like Saving Private Ryan when they came out, was that they were like, oh, this isn't a... It's not a glamorous thing, you know, there's guys crying and there's people just wishing they could go home, and
yeah.
I assume people saw it as a more honest portrayal in that sense. But
I remember that being part of the reception for sure.
Yeah, and I suppose, like I was saying, when you sort of get into the era of kind of AAA big budget game development now and really in-depth sound design and all that sort of stuff, where it really is much more immersive. Like if you play a game like that with headphones on, that sort of stuff, it's a whole different thing. It's a whole different experience to anything that you could have imagined playing a game, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. And if you think about 20 years from now, you're probably not too far off.
Well, yeah. I mean, people are already talking about, you do get people coming out and saying, soon we'll be able to just put an implant in your brain and you'll learn a thing just like that. Or we'll be able to put someone's memories in someone else. And then you get a whole bunch of scientists going, that's not how brains work. You can't just do that. Yeah. Well, I mean, but the number one thing, like when you talk about all that kind of like, we'll put an electrode in your brain and then we can just make you think you're having an experience, which is probably something you shouldn't fuck around with inside people's brains anyway. but yeah, I mean, the general takeaway of that kind of, that idea is that you then get a lot of, you know, neuroscientists and stuff coming out and saying, we barely know anything about brains.
Let alone to the point where we can plug something in and download it.
That's right. So yeah, I think
might be VR, might be experience as opposed to knowledge.
Well, yeah, over the next, you know, 20 or 30 years or whatever, if they manage to, you know, get increasingly sort of higher fidelity graphics and sound design and screens and all that sort of stuff for that kind of thing, then you could potentially be creating those experiences for people to interact with it without them, you know, necessarily having to have somebody's memories implanted into their brain or anything like that.
Well, that's a fantastic answer. It opens up actually a number of doors that we're going to have to talk about next time you're on. So
man, I would love that.
Thanks again, Andrew. Really appreciate it. This was a blast.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Again, follow Andrew at Illybocian, I-L-L-Y-B-O-C-A. B-O-C-E-A-N. It's a play on Billy Ocean, which I didn't know until Andrew told me earlier. We've been following each other for probably about a year now, so that's a little embarrassing. But and listen to his podcast with a number of other Twitter luminaries. Say the name.
Bunta Vista.
Bunta Vista. Yeah, Bunta Vista.
The Bunta Vista Socialist Club. With Thomas Violence and Lucy Valentine, who some of you may or may not know from Twitter. And just for your reference, Bunta is an Australian expression from South Australia particularly, and it just means like going wild, going crazy.
All right. That's two Australian slang terms you have heard if you are a patron as well. We now know, so, you know, this is an educational podcast and, you know, that's just value right there. So thanks again, man. Come back anytime and good talking to you.
Thank you very much.